right, great. Yeah, well, first off, welcome to RaffleCon, too. We haven't formally invited you. We're super glad you're all here. Definitely excited, and it looks like it's going to be a pretty ridiculous weekend. So the lay of the land is pretty easy this morning. We've got a keynote from Ethan Zuckerman and Dana Boyd. I'll let them kind of introduce and talk themselves. But in any case, without further ado, Dana, Ethan?
Howdy. I'm Ethan. This is Data. We're going to try to give a keynote together. We'll see how that goes. I'm going to start. Hi.
Hi.
Thank you. That really helped, actually. So look, this is a really weird way to start this conference, because the truth is, despite the fact that there are a couple of academics here, we are absolutely not who you are coming to see. And we all know that, right? So we get to try to actually keep you entertained, knowing full well that there are far, far more interesting people coming after us. And I have to say, it actually reminds me of what I used to do as an academic, because I used to be a musicologist. And what happens is, you go and you study Bach, and you try to figure out how all this stuff works, and you realize that no matter what you do, you are never going to write a rock and fugue. And it's a really serious problem, because at a certain point you sort of go, why the hell am I doing this? And the same question comes in with internet memes, because you realize that no matter how good you are at this, and how much you understand about this, you are never going to create the mystery and the wonder that is Keyboard Cat. And I just want to explain the problem that Dana and I have. We have to deal with that hard, difficult truth every day of our lives. We try to understand this stuff, but we understand that ultimately we are in fact outsiders. We are looking at an internet culture, we are theorizing, we are opining, but we are not in fact the creators. So thank God, generally speaking, this is not normally my problem, because normally I study something slightly else. What I study is how information works in the developing world. And so I'm interested in the internet, but I'm also interested in community radio. I'm interested in mobile phones. I'm interested in general in how poor people use technology. And I'm really interested in the question of how technology might over time make people less poor. And pretty much if you do development economics, you're really interested in one question. And the one question is this: why are some people really, really rich, and why are other people really, really poor? And it turns out there's a whole bunch of different answers to this. Some of those answers are actually pretty good. Some of them kind of suck. The answers that are pretty good tend to be based around history in one fashion or another. Who colonized who? Who had animals you could tame? Who had malaria, which means that you spend like, you know, one out of every 3 weeks in a fever? The really bad answers, as it turns out, are answers that basically postulate that there are some human beings who are smart and some human beings who are dumb. And we used to call this eugenics, and we used to sort of say, hey, let's find the really smart people and let's breed them together so that we have some sort of a super race. And now we call it the bell curve, and we basically say, hey, isn't it interesting? All the white wealthy people, they must be really smart. That must be why they dominate the world. Not really asking questions of whether these are actually fair tests to ask of people. So what I'm interested in is basically the notion that creativity comes from literally every corner of the globe. That guy up there is a guy named William Kamkwamba. He's a friend of mine. He's from Malawi. And William had kind of a tough childhood, which is basically to say that he spent most of his childhood starving and had his brothers and sisters die. And when his family finally got to the point where they were no longer worried about where the next meal was from, he had a very interesting problem, which is that he really wanted to listen to the radio and he couldn't afford batteries. And so rather than approaching this problem any other way, he decided to build a tower, put a bicycle on top of it, make a windmill out of PVC pipe, and use it to power his radio. And the trick is, you meet a couple of these guys, and you quickly realize that any of these theories that basically say some people are born smart and some people are born dumb, some people are more creative than others, is basically a stinking pile of shit. And so I'm interested in what happens when we get to the point where people like William, who are utterly brilliant, suddenly have the chance to be brilliant in front of the entire world. And so this leads me to a question that I suspect is far more germane today than the rich and poor, which is this one, which is, Daddy, where do memes come from? And by the way, this is going to be a real question in our household, because my wife has sort of gone a little bit nuts with Cafe Press. And beyond that, I would say that this is Andrew Wynn, who is 5 months old today. Say hi, Andrew. One of the reasons Andrew Wynn's middle name is Wynn is so we could name his blog For the Win, and so that gives you some sort of a sense for what kind of parents we are. So, you know, this kid's going to be in therapy for a very, very long time. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Normally, when we ask this question, where do the memes come from, we like to look at maps. And so we look to maps that help enlighten us about the nature of the internet. And the truth is, we know that internet creativity is concentrated in equatorial regions. It's particularly strong in the Gulf of YouTube, moving out through the ocean of culture into the straits of subculture. We know that it's a highly regionalized phenomenon. In the frigid north, it tends not to be as common. We also know that there are particular areas of this map that, through their rich soils, burned to the ground by countless waves of flame wars and built up through the charcoal that has arisen, that end a particularly fertile ground for internet memes. But I want to suggest that there's actually another sort of map that we might consider when we consider internet memes, and this is a map that I've been building. This is built with data from our friends at Know Your Meme, and it's built very simplistically. I've gone in and essentially said, where are my Vietnamese memes? Where are my Filipino memes? Knowing full well that this is probably a slightly biased set, knowing full well that there's probably better representation of the US and Japan. But what I got out of this is that memetic creativity is tightly tied to internet penetration, how long we've had internet in different places. And this has some really interesting implications. So for those of us who study development economics, we keep talking about the BRIC. B-R-I-C, Brazil, Russia, India, China. And the reason we keep talking about the BRIC is because someone at Goldman Sachs, before we all thought they were lying sacks of shit, published a report which said by 2050, BRIC countries are going to basically own the world. They've got the people, they've got the resources, they've got the drive, they've got the creativity. It's possible that by 2050, the US is actually going to be sort of a marginal economy. We're going to look more like the UK than like the world dominators that we do now. And what's interesting about this is that as we bring this into the far more relevant realm of internet memetic studies, we discover that they are already, in fact, taking the lead. And you can think of internet memes coming out of the BRIC as sort of being the forefront of where we're going. The Chinese have been putting forth Brother Sharp, a particularly stylish homeless man who founds himself starring in a number of major Hollywood motion pictures. Probably without his knowledge, it sounds like Brother Sharp has some problems that people have been trying to help him work through. Our superhero from Russia, I'm not going to try to pronounce the name in Russian, but I will say that his superhero name is Big Eyes. India obviously has incredible cultural dominance through Bollywood. They have, in fact, taken over Thriller. They've brought it into the realm of Golimar, which I have to say is far more entertaining than Thriller ever was to me. And if you haven't experienced Tenso in Brazil, you should really see the slide that I wanted to put up there. But Tenso in general are series of images that, as you get closer and closer to them, get slightly more disturbing. And I'll just let you go with that. You'll work it out. So my point in all of this is, if we go back to this map, first of all, let me say, I'm an Africanist. That's where I work, that's where I study, that's where I used to live. I am deeply troubled by that giant white spot in the middle of the map, and fortunately, I am here to tell you that the Africans are fighting back. So I've had the great experience recently of watching Kenya's first major internet meme come to the fore. And this meme is called Makmende, and it's based around this video, which usually is not quite that loud. So as you might have figured out by now, and if we could hold on the music just a little bit, Makmende is basically halfway between Shaft and Kanye West. He is a superhero for our times. He kicks ass, he doesn't bother taking names, he always gets the girl, although he often forgets who she is. He is basically the face of modern Kenya mixed with 1970s blaxploitation films. I highly recommend you watch this video as often as you possibly can. But let me say, this thing swept through the Kenyan blogosphere, and you guys are laughing and going, what Kenyan blogosphere? But it turns out there are several thousand very active Kenyan bloggers. And the first question we had to ask is, well, all right, maybe we should just watch this, actually. So the first thing we had to figure out is what the hell does the word Makmende mean? So Makmende is a word that if you grew up in Nairobi in the 1990s, people would use this to refer to the guy who thought he was a ninja. You know, the guy who's walking around the neighborhood and he's always throwing the kicks and trying to beat everybody up, and someone goes, "Who the hell do you think you are, Makmende?" And the phrase Makmende Amarudi is Makmende is back. So this is an old cultural reference coming back. So we started talking about this. Everyone assumed that Makmende meant something in Sheng, which is the slang language made out of Swahili and English. It turns out that it does, but the root of the word is go ahead, make my day. Makmende. So this took us a while to figure out. I mean, seriously, this is, you know, this mimetic studies stuff. This is not easy to track this down. But what started happening very, very quickly is that Makmende started getting remixed in some fairly fascinating ways. He found his way onto the currency in almost no time. And one of the things is the band who did this, they're called Just a Band, they're on board with it. They basically said, look, we sort of reserve the right, we might do a Makmende movie one of these days. If you're going to put out a t-shirt, you know, we want to know about it, but go ahead, remix non-commercially, we're cool with it. And so what happened pretty quickly is we started seeing videos like this.
I can't believe this. Okay. Now let me go. Ah! No!
Which is somewhere between Makmende meets the Blair Witch Project, which is even funnier if you know that the guy with the microphone is part of KTN, which is Kenya's largest television network. So this thing doesn't just break through, it sort of broke through at the very highest levels. You will be unsurprised, by the way, to know that Hitler's a little worried about Makmende as
my
well.
Steiner. Steiner konnte nicht genügend Kräfte für einen Angriff massieren. Der Angriff Steiner ist nicht erfolgt.
I would also go further and point out that the amazing thing about this is that Makmende has managed not to get taken down from YouTube, which is pretty impressive. But basically, where most of this has taken place is on Makmende.com, which is basically Chuck Norris facts with an African twist. You probably can't see this, but the top one there basically says something along the lines of, when Makmende gets bitten by an infected mosquito, the mosquito gets infected. And they sort of go somewhere along those lines, and there are more than 10,000 of these. So this went really, really crazy very, very quickly. And for me, what this really got me thinking about was hedgehogs. And specifically, what it got me thinking about is my friend Erin McKean. Erin is a lexicographer. She's a dictionary maker. And she goes out and she talks about the job of people who make dictionaries. And she says, look, the problem is everybody thinks that we're bouncers. They think that we're the guys who stand outside the word club with our arms crossed and sort of say, no, that's not a word, that's a word. Yeah, you can come in. No, stay out there. The truth is, what lexicographers basically are anthropologists. And what they're looking for are what are the words that people are actually using. Because the way that a word makes it into the language, like Erinaceous, is if people actually use it. If you use it and you love it, it's part of the language. And that's clearly how internet memes work. If no one loves it, if no one uses it, if no one remixes it, if no one grabs it, it doesn't have life. If they do, it does. And it sort of doesn't matter what anybody else says. If you love Makmende, Makmende's a meme. And if you work with Makmende, Makmende's a meme. And it doesn't matter what anybody says, except it kind of matters what Wikipedia says. So, one of the first things our Kenyan friends did when Makmende came upon the scene is they said, let's make sure that we get a Makmende Wikipedia entry. They put together a Makmende Wikipedia entry, summary deletion. Comes through three times, bang, bang, bang. They weren't very good entries. They probably weren't even very good stubs. But part of it was the people editing it going, what the hell are you talking about? And finally, the Kenyan crew figured out what they had to do, which is they had to say, this is our first internet meme. This is our thing. At which point Wikipedia said, all right, that's cool, that's your thing, go with it, get it there. But let me point out for a moment to our friends at Know Your Meme, it got Deadpooled immediately, died, day one, six comments, gone. And I've in fact sort of hung back from jumping in and trying to revive it because I've been hoping that the Kenyan crew will come in and revive it. I'm now hoping that someone in this room will come in and revive it because I actually think it's one of the better things that's come up recently. But my point here is that this thing that we are jointly building together, there's the danger that we become the bouncers. There's the danger that we end up, out of our love for the thing, becoming the gatekeepers. And there's a really interesting open question about who's in and who's out. Is it okay that this is a Kenyan meme and that this probably doesn't make sense outside of Kenya? I mean, so here's the thing. You can join in. You can add Makmende facts. but it's a little tricky. So one of the better ones out there tells you that Machmende hangs his clothes on a Safaricom line. And that probably makes no sense to you unless you know that Safaricom is the main wireless operator in the country, owns no telephone lines, which makes it significantly more interesting that he's found a way to hang his clothes on the Safaricom line, but also means that you might find yourself looking at this and going, hey man, I'm not Kenyan. I don't know what I'm doing with this. This isn't a meme for me to remix. One of the interesting things is what does get us all to get on board. What is the meme that all of us can participate in? And generally speaking, it's something that's already crossed cultures at least once. It really helps the Backdoor Boys that we know the song. And we know that anybody lip-syncing this song is going to look goofy, which makes it a whole lot easier for us to go into a dorm room and look equally goofy remixing this meme. And we end up in some fashion in this sort of global embrace of goofy identity based around something that we all feel comfortable remixing. So here's my question. What's the meme that we're all going to love? And I raise this as a very serious internet question. And this is a serious internet question in as much as something that we study over at the Berkman Center, where for some reason I continue to be employed. We're really interested in questions like, is there one internet or are there many? And one of the things that we're all worried about is China, right? So China's done something really, really interesting. China has blocked off really big chunks of the internet that we care about. It's a really serious pain in the ass to get to YouTube in China. But it's really easy to get to Youku, and Youku is completely in Mandarin, and all the content on it is appropriate to China. It's also heavily censored. But here's the thing. China has bridged the cute cat gap. And this is a very frightening geopolitical moment for us. We did not know that China had cute cat technology. But it turns out that if you search for funny cat on Youku, it is quite clear that they may in fact have cute cat dominance. And I'm here to tell you something even worse. They have cats flushing toilets. And not just Western style toilets, they have cats flushing pit toilets. They are far ahead of us in cute cat technology. Now the thing is, we generally don't loll at Chinese lolcats, and Chinese don't generally loll at our lolcats. And the problem with this is that this has the potential to actually lead us towards a more divided internet. We've already got an internet that's split apart by language. We tend not to look at the Chinese stuff. They tend not to look at the English stuff. It's split apart by the local rules of the road. However you behave on this site might be, I hope is, better than how you behave on YouTube. And over time, you might even end up at the point where we have different protocols. We end up with internets that aren't talking to one another, and it's possible that we could end up at some point with internets that literally cannot talk to one another. So the case that I am making here is that it is of enormous geopolitical strategic importance that we build memes that Chinese people laugh at, and that Chinese people share memes that we laugh at, because this is what allows us to have a single connected internet. Now here's the problem with this. When we try this, we sometimes don't come up with the best ways of laughing together. Now, let me first say, I love a good piece of English as much as everybody else. And there's no possible way you can put up this slide and not get a good laugh out of it. But the problem with this is that the easiest way to try to cross culture is to laugh at, right? It's pretty easy to laugh at people failing to translate English well. It's even pretty easy to laugh at people who have a history of failing to translate English well. And so if Mahir is in the room, let me just start by saying, Mahir, I kiss you too. And the reason I kiss you, Mahir, so many reasons, but the reason I kiss you in this particular context is that when Mahir sprung onto the scene, back when we were using computers that looked like this one, he was being laughed at. And he figured it out. He figured out that we were laughing at him, and he took an amazing step. He said, you're laughing at me, I'm going to laugh with you. We're going to laugh about this together. I'm going to let this become my identity. I'm going to let you in on the joke. I'm going to make it clear that you're in on the joke with me, and we're going to go from lolling at to lolling with. And so in that sense, he's my idol. And my other idol in this, by the way, is Matt Harding, who I don't know if we have in the room. But Matt did an amazing job of looking like a complete dumbass in every corner of the world doing this wonderfully silly dance. And I kiss you too, Matt. This is not, by the way, why I love Matt. This is why I love Matt. And I'm going to explain this to you, because I don't know that he's explained this to you. Matt became very, very famous with that video. And that video uses a somewhat troublesome piece of music, right? It's a piece called Sweet Lullaby. It's done by a band called Deep Forest. They're these guys down here on the left. They're a bunch of French techno musicians. The problem with this song, which sold 3 million copies, showed up in countless advertisements, made an enormous amount of money, is that it's on an album of music that claims to be pygmy music. Pygmy music comes from Central Africa. The music that he actually ends up using on this song that ends up being remixed all over the place is recorded, first of all, by a guy named Hugo Zemp, who's the third figure in there, and who's roughly as famous as Dana Boyd in ethnomusicology circles. Like, if he was up on stage here, we'd all be chanting, Hugo, Hugo. And it's recorded in the Solomon Islands, which you'll notice are pretty far from where there are actually any pygmies. And what is greatly to Matt's credit is that he figured this out. And his response was to make a video that was significantly less viral, but a whole lot more important.
She told her small brother, our sister, to keep quiet.
So Matt's response to this is to say, here's this piece of music that's made my world infinitely weirder. It's made me internet famous, it's brought me all over the world, people know who I am. But it's also got this really interesting possibility. It's got the possibility of making my world wider. By making this decision not just to use this piece of music, but to find out the story and to go out and literally do the research and go literally to one of the furthest corners of the earth to try to figure out the story behind this. And for that, Matt is my internet hero. He's my hero of the internet that I want to see us have.
Even though you cry.
I want to see an internet where we keep going from being weird to being wide. And I just don't mean that in terms of waistline, although it's worked very well for me, but I mean that in terms of looking for ways in from the things that we love and care about into ways that you can broaden and explore the world. I'm interested in this question of, can we get beyond lolling at and get to the point of lolling with? And the reason that I care about this is that I think it's far, far cooler to approach the internet as an anthropologist rather than as a bouncer. I don't like this idea that some of us are going to sit here and say, this is internet culture and this isn't. I'm hoping that we end up at the point where we go, this is internet culture from a corner that I've never explored before, and I'm totally psyched about it, and I want to find a way to bring it into my club. I think it's absolutely critical, and I'm dead serious about this, that we look for ways that we're all laughing at the same thing, because that's where culture comes from. It comes from shared reference, it comes from shared belief, and if we don't get to the point where we and Chinese internet users and Indian internet users and Vietnamese and Pakistanis and Kenyans are lolling at the same thing, we're losing something that's very, very special and very, very precious. And finally, I want to remind you to use the word erinaceous, because it is very, very beautiful, and it doesn't become a word unless we love it. So, thank you.
So Ethan is one of my heroes, and one of the reasons why is that he's constantly reminding us that culture has these different inflections around the world. And I actually want to take the same moment to sort of step back and think about how this is rooted within our own histories here. A lot of what we talk about, we're talking about is culture, but really what we're experiencing is subculture and all of the histories and meanings of subculture. One of the best and most delightful things about internet subculture is that it has been dominated for a long time by self-described geeks, freaks, and queers, right? Of which I am proudly one of those people and have been forever. And if you look back to the games that played on Usenet, they came from these origin spaces, right? And there's interesting trends that sort of weave through all of this, things we continue to laugh at. Cats have been funny for a long time, and it makes me really happy to always go back to that reminder of when alt.tasteless decided that they had to invade rec.pets.cats to teach them how to cook cats. Love it, love it. So the thing about geek, freak, and queer culture is it's been core to a lot of what's going on in every little iteration. And we can think about this at every form of social intervention, right? All of the new social media, everything we've seen, got first embraced by geeks, freaks, and queers. Everybody always talks about youth. It actually has nothing to do with youth. It has to do with all of these subcultures and all of these marginalized populations. And I think it's important to think about how that comes back. But what do we have to deal with now that things have gone mainstream? And on one hand, this is super exciting, right? All of these things, all of the cats are everywhere, right? And people are laughing at cats everywhere on the street. It's a little eerie, right? You go into any place and you realize that people know the same jokes. And it's a really delightful moment, but it also has a point of criticalness. Because the question that keeps coming back is, what is inside, what is outside? All of these boundary questions that Ethan is pointing out. One of the things, you know, as a social scientist, my goal is always to try to contextualize things, to try to make sense of them in history, to realize what's similar and what's different, and to make connections between things. One of the things that I love in all of this history is the connections to rave culture, of which there are tremendous. And one of the most important theorists, actually, there are academics who study rave culture, surprisingly enough. One of the most important of these is a woman by the name of Sarah Thornton. And one of the things that she argued was the absolute essentialness of subcultural capital. Now, you've heard capital in economic sense. You've heard capital in all sorts of, you know, social capital and all of these. Well, Bourdieu, one of these sort of great theorists, got very interested in the notion of cultural capital. And it's where we got into this obsession with high culture and low culture, right? And there was high culture in the idea that the opera was high culture. And people who attended the opera had high cultural capital. They were important. And the key with cultural capital is that everybody understood that this was important. And it was about a lack of access. Not anybody could get access to the high, important things. It required money, it required privilege, it required connections. And then along came a whole set of subcultures that reminded us that this isn't the only way to build culture. And part of the beautiful things when we think about subcultural capital is that the access is extremely easy, but being in the know is extremely hard. Right? Finding out where the interesting thing is hard. And this is the beauty of the rave, right? Showing up to a rave wasn't that expensive, but figuring out where it was really hard. And the same ends up happening with the DJ culture, right? Knowing what the cool new song was, that's hard. But once you hear it, you can spread it like wildfire. So if we think about a lot of what's going on in this space, we realize the connection between subcultural capital. But the challenge here is that everything speeds up. Right? We have this really interesting moment where at one time it would take weeks, right, for a song to go from East Coast to West Coast. Now, minutes. Right? We have this point in which something becomes really cool and takes off. We have the ability to point to it and look at it. And that's extremely powerful. But it also raises some really interesting challenges in all of us. And part of it is to follow the money. One of the things about money, and money keeps inflecting internet culture in all sorts of weird ways. And we're right now in the middle of yet another boom. Ethan and I had the privilege and misfortune of living through the last one of these, right? And it was really interesting because when you grew up in all of this sort of great culture and you were like, this is so fascinating, we could do amazing things, and then all of a sudden you saw the MBAs invade your space, and you're like, why are people wearing suits? What is going on here? What happened to my San Francisco? And you didn't understand what was making sense. And 1999, for all of the, you know, Prince lovely songs, was really not necessarily the party that many of us geeks, freaks, and queers really wanted to be partying like. It was a little eerie, and part of it was the economic issues. And we saw this rise and boom, and when we saw this glorious, glorious crash, right? And the funny thing that happened after the crash was that we had this moment to reconsider what it meant to be weird. And we got to see another sort of moving of culture. The culture that all of you are here celebrating really came out of this moment when everything had sort of faded. The MBAs were like, the internet, that was a nice fad. We don't want anything to do with the internet. No more internet. Right? And we're like, good, bye-bye. Good riddance. Don't want to see you again. And we went on our merry way. But the funny thing is that while the MBAs may have taken over Web 1, we have another round of boom, and we have another takeover group who's totally invading this cultural space, and that is the marketer. Right? The marketer has become this sort of crazy, crazy space of saying, ha, not only are we going to take it over because this has money, this has potential, we can do crazy things with it, and they want to sort of own all of this. And it becomes this really interesting moment for all of what we think about as subcultural capital, because you know what marketers are really good at or really obsessed with? Cool hunting. They want to find the coolest, newest trends and follow it. And all of a sudden, being weird got to be cool, right? Wearing a t-shirt to work got to be normal. All of this that we sort of take for granted as the sort of artifacts of subculture have become mainstream culture. And what does that mean? What does that look like? And what is the money implications in all of this? Now, this isn't new. Business loves subculture, right? Boy, I mean, Hot Topic is like a moment of twitching over my childhood rave feelings, right? Like, how can you commercialize this? Of course, that in itself isn't new, right? One of the best things about punk, if we think back to the old days of punk, was that there was really no distinction between that which was punk, which was underground subculture challenging the whole, you know, means of authority, and that which was a commercial entity where you were supposed to show up to the store to buy it, right? That blending has always been part of it. So if we think about what For the Lulz means, we have to think about what it means to do these collective things that have different implications, right? The collective implication of the monetization of the space, but also the politicization. And the question is, what is all the political moves that go on with everything that's going here? Right, we think about the datists, we think about the surrealists, we think about the yippies. All of them had these moves, and people who were participating in it were participating in it for the Lulz. They didn't call it that. I give all of you the Lulz. But the thing is that they were very much saying, we're going to do it in entertainment, and each of us individually will participate because it's fun. But what does it mean when we gather everybody together? What is the collective move in all of this? How do we think about that? As we celebrate For the Lulz, we're at a really interesting crossroads, one where we have to think through what the implications are. When I was a teenager, my friends were hackers, right? And we spent a lot of time breaking into anything we could get our hands on, right? And we loved just to see whose systems we could break. And, you know, part of it was pure entertainment. I don't think any of us thought twice about what we were doing. We wanted to see how stupid people could be. Did they really make their passwords password for reals? Right? And we spent a lot of time sort of joking around about this and just not even thinking about what it meant. Until one day, the boy that I was dating in high school was arrested for breaking into the Navy's security system. Right? And I was like, well, we thought it was funny. We thought, why not, right? The last attack we had done right before that was to break into the school system because a friend of mine had lost her tuba, and we thought that erasing that record would be a really good thing, even though we could never figure out how she'd lost her tuba. As we'd broken into these things and fixing the tuba problem, same as fixing national security. No big deal, right? But of course, his arrest made us question a lot of what was going on, and all of a sudden, in the process of trying to defend him, we found out that there was a much wider culture. A much wider group of people who were engaged in hacking and freaking and otherwise playing around with this space. And we had to ask ourselves what that meant to be part of a larger collective. And I think it's really interesting to think about the ways in which these collectives start to come up and you start to think about the political implications of it. So I spend a lot of time with teenagers. That's one of my favorite things in the world to do, is to run around the United States talking to teens about all sorts of weird things that they do and their love of the internet and all of the different ways we see this play out. For most teens that I interview, things are so mainstream. They read and consume the different kind of cultural memes that you put out there, but they don't really think twice about it. What I find fascinating is the hacker culture that I knew and grew up with, the idea of breaking security systems, by and large, that's gone. I don't see those kids in the way that I used to. That kind of politicization that's about challenging authority in that particular way, it's not really there. There are exceptions, of course. There are always going to be exceptions. But the way that that dominated every single community where I grew up, not so much. But there was something very interesting going on, a similar kind of mindset, but it was a different kind of hacking. It's become a type of social hacking. It's no longer about hacking the socio-political in the ways of hacking the security system. It's about hacking the attention economy. Right? It's about creating things for the Lulz just to see what would happen. Can you get something buzzing? Can you get something going? And all sorts of people who don't even know that this conference are going on are doing this because it's fun, because they see the things that you're doing. They don't realize that there's a collective. But it's also a beautiful untapped potential. Right? This question of how to be political. And in many ways, you become all of these role models for a next generation of hackers, the people who are going to challenge the system. But what are they challenging? How are they going to participate in things? Part of this social hacking has this interesting question of what is actually the long-term goals. And one of the things that sort of scares me as I've started to watch different rifts play out in this community is that we're now becoming cultural capital, not just subcultural capital. We're getting attention, we're getting money, we're making a living, we're becoming famous not just amongst 15, but amongst a lot of people who have a lot more power and authority. And boy, is the taste of that power beautiful and delicious, right? The possibilities of becoming famous, about appearing on various mainstream TV shows, becoming mainstream, becoming the dominant discourse. But the question that we have to ask in all of this is, what do we lose in this process? What are the economic possibilities of this? And what does it mean to the next generation who's trying to challenge the system? How much of the decisions that you make about challenging authority or challenging systems, how much are them about actually just becoming part of the mainstream and getting validated? And it's a really sticky set of questions to be asking in this space, because I know we're going after all of the people that are selling out. And it's one of the rifts that I keep seeing in this space. But it's not even a question of who's selling out or who's not, because nobody's even quite sure what that means anymore. Because what is selling out when, you know, you've got advertising coming in this way, you're getting paid in all of these weird ways? What does it mean to sell out? I work for Microsoft Research, right? Like, to what degree is that selling out? And to what degree is that trying to change things from the inside? And so the thing that to keep in mind in all of this is that many of you grew up in that hacker mindset. Keeping hold of that hacker mindset, realizing that that infuses the subculture with which we are a part of, and figuring out how to pull that out and constantly own that. So as you play about in these couple of days, thinking about where this is going and thinking about what kind of hacker you want to be. What kind of cultural hacker are you? Where is the culture that you're going? And how do you make certain that the hacking that you're doing helps make connections and not just splinters in all sorts of new ways? Subcultures love to splinter themselves. They're very good at it. But there's an amazing potential, especially embodied by the people in this room, to bring it all together and to have fun with it. Thanks.
Wow. Let's do a couple of things here. First, let's throw up a question tool if we can, so we can take some questions from the audience. But while those come out, I mean, Dana, let me sort of ask the first question here, which is that if I'm reading you right, you're saying a couple of things. The first thing you seem to be saying is that we're hacking different systems nowadays. We're not necessarily hacking the physical infrastructure. In fact, that fooling around with the physical infrastructure of the web has become so common that, you know, many of us in this room were employed in it. But instead, what we're still trying to figure out how to hack is attention. At the same time, you seem to be pointing to something that I guess I'm going to refer to as the crisis in weirdness, which is to say that what happens when the weird goes mainstream really, really quickly? Are we suffering from a national weirdness deficit? Because I'm not sure I'd noticed that yet.
I don't think that we're in a national weirdness crisis. I think that we are very much playing with all sorts of things, but we're running into a new and interesting tension, which is to what degree are we actually feeding off of the possibilities of the attention economy and becoming the attention economy, and what points are we challenging the attention economy? And I think this is actually where it's quite confusing to see those two different things. I mean, what does it mean that the moment we get a meme out there, it all of a sudden becomes a commercial? Right, and how does that actually get embodied in different ways? Because, you know, it's exciting to see our memes out there. It's exciting to become part of the attention economy. But the attention economy is where the mainstream is going. It's where everybody, if you look at what's happening with all of the major social media, all of the big companies, right, it's all about becoming part of the attention economy, about monetizing the behavioral attention that we can possibly generate from people. And so at the same time that we're building these things to challenge it, we're also becoming part of it. And I think that's one of the most difficult and frustrating things about being a cultural hacker at any point, is to figure out what happens when you've become salient enough to become the culture. Right? And I think that that's where we're seeing it. And that's where I say, for you, I think this is an interesting challenge, right? Because what does it mean, you know, when MacMende becomes part of that commercial enterprise? Like, how does that look at it all?
Well, so, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, the reason Kenyans wanted so badly for MacMende...
The
screen is just sort of like pursuing me. It just, you know, it's sort of haunting me over my shoulder. This is sort of freaking me out, guys. So here's the thing. I mean, like, thank you. Look, what my Kenyan... what my Kenyan friends wanted more than anything else was the rest of the world to pay attention to this. And... when you get this, you don't just get the message of, you know, MacMende's so tough that they tried to make a MacMende toilet paper, but it wouldn't take shit from anybody, which is a good message to get. But beyond that, the message is, hey, look, we're Kenya, we're on the internet, we make pretty good music videos, we've got some really good graphic designers, we've got a sense of humor, we'd love to be part of this. And if you think about that, that's actually a pretty different image and vision of Kenya than pretty much most people have. Most people who know the country, know anything about it, know the ethnic violence they went through in 2007, 2008, think about animals. They're not really thinking about three dudes with a laptop making a music video. And so the meme becomes a way of sort of trying to vault into global cultural consciousness. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is why this notion of attention as currency is this really interesting idea for those of us who are studying political spaces, network spaces, because this is the really scarce thing right now. Now that everybody in this room has a voice, is saying something online or will say something online, the really scarce thing is who do people choose to pay attention to? And so as people start figuring this out and figure out how consistently to sort of stand up and not just grab the microphone, but really grab someone's attention for some period of time, that's where the power comes into play.
I think one of the things you've pointed out over the years is that people have a tendency to pay attention to the things that they already know, and to pay attention to things in ways that really reproduce all sorts of structural systems. And so when you look at it, all of these people here who have this amazing opportunity and ability to sort of both drive attention and be part of that dynamic, how do you think that, you know, what is their role in thinking about the global dynamics and how to drive and think about attention as it relates to some of these structural inequality questions?
Well, interestingly enough, so there's a question that just showed up over your shoulder, which is pretty much, you know, exactly along those lines, which is basically, does it make any sense to pursue knowledge of internet culture that's sort of outside of your own culture, right? I mean, you get the benefit from being in the know within your own circle. And for me, this actually, it's almost exactly the same question as I got from a journalist friend the other day. And I was grousing about the fact that 4,000 people go and report on Haiti, which is really important. It's really cool that people are reporting on Haiti. I'm glad we did. But if 2,000 people covered Haiti and like 2,000 covered something else, that might be helpful too. Or maybe two could go here and two could go there, and maybe we could look at the world a little bit more. But the problem is the advantage is to be reporter 4,001 who says something new and says something cool. And there's a great benefit to be in on the meme that everybody else is in on. So I'm not an optimist about this. Like, I actually think what Makmende showed me is that we have a Kenyan internet culture. It's really cool. It's starting to have a lot of fun. It's pretty much unknown in the US. And there are going to be a few people who kind of stand on the edges between the two and try to have conversations. But I think we're getting to the point where you're really worried about the subcultures that you grew up in getting mainstreamed within this country. I'm interested in the fact that the subcultures that I'm seeing are global and they don't mix real easily. It's really hard to figure out what's going on the Chinese internet. It's not just throwing it through Google Translate. It won't make any sense. You need someone to come and lead you through it. And so I think we're probably getting maybe less subcultural at home, but I think we now have this broad, wide world of subcultures and that they're separated linguistically in one fashion or another.
No, I mean, I think that actually that's really important because, I mean, one of the reasons why subcultures emerge is because people feel as though they need their identity to make sense. And one of the reasons why kids in particular turn to subcultures is because they sit there and be like, oh my gosh, I look around the people at school and I don't understand them. They make no sense to me. Please let me find something that is better. I mean, this is what got me online as a teenager, right? Which was that nothing around me made any sense. And I was like, yikes. And so one of the questions that I keep coming back to is how do we make certain that things make sense for people? And that's where we get these different questions about proximity. So a lot of where subcultures came into being is to say that the local proximity, right, like being cool among in your school wasn't going to work for everybody. So how can I find other people who are like me where I can get these kinds of validation? And so the challenge when I think about these subcultures is that they became about social proximity, about all of these identity markers to connect people that way. And so I can imagine wanting to be cool amongst the Kenyan internet becoming extremely important, but that's still geographically there. What are the kinds of ways in which we actually connect lines across the globe? Where are the common similarnesses that allow us to connect that are not just about all breathing the same culture? Because I don't know that we want necessarily one global culture as much as we want possible subcultures that are not actually geographically grounded.
So maybe that's actually the answer to question five, which I think might have just become question six again, which is to say, so what's so valuable about a coherent internet as opposed to having this fragment? You said you were really worried about this fragmenting, and then the question is, does coherency get us towards more effective politics? Does it have any benefits? Does this help us in some fashion? Is it okay if we just have an internet of subcultures, or are the marketers just going to go and figure out how to make money off of them and then advertise them to the rest of us?
Yeah, because I'm not arguing that actually the fragmentation is a bad thing. In fact, I think something is really powerful about having all of these fragmented worlds where you belong. The challenge is that as we think about the attention economy, a lot of people are trying to take these fragments and make them into something that is coherent, but actually depoliticizing it in the process. Whereas each of those little acts by subcultures, even if it's for the lols, actually has a political statement of saying, hey, I don't actually like what is normative or, you know, culturally acceptable in these particular ways. I want to sort of challenge something, whether it's culture or whether it's challenging something that's deeply political. But they are actually one and the same. And the thing is how do we actually make certain that that can actually stay with its sort of richness and stay with its connectivity and stay with the place where it actually builds people's identity and gives them strength and power to make change and doesn't just become some sort of tool that leaves them feeling like they're depoliticized, they're disengaged, they're not part of anything, or they've become part of that mainstream.
So one of the other questions that's sort of coming up there is wondering whether basically you and I are old. And
yes.
And sort of, you know, and we are, and that's part of it. Like, this is why my 1994 laptop and my, by the way, this works. This is the QuickTake 100. This is the first consumer digital camera. And although it's low on battery, if it weren't low on battery, it actually flashes. It's kind of exciting. But we're so old that we think of hacker as a culture. And as sort of helpfully being pointed out here, that's sort of ludicrous, that, you know, the BTARDs are sort of their own crew. And they may not identify as hackers. You know, whoever's doing Rickrolls probably isn't identifying as hackers. You know, the emergence of something like Anonymous, that's clearly its own cultural identity. You know, were we basically just longing for a world that was sort of so small and so isolated that we knew everybody? And now we're sort of facing this big, broad, fragmented internet where maybe we know some of these people, but we don't know all of these people? I mean, is this, you know, you and I both grew up in very, very small towns and we go off and face the big city. Are we just growing up and facing the grown-up internet?
I mean, I am definitely getting old. It's rather disturbing. And I realize that I actually know more about like old Usenet lore than I know about contemporary meme culture, and that's really disturbing, especially to be the keynote where I'm like, what am I doing here? I want to listen to you. But I think that there's actually something that becomes these historical cycles. And I think if anything that's us old folks can sort of, you know, impart is some of the ways in which these are cycles. That yes, it is definitely not the same as hacker culture, but yet there is a social hacking to it. And there are these patterns that are really similar. And I had I had one of the sort of funniest moments ever when I was invited to speak at the 35th anniversary of the internet to represent all youth. And I was like, what the hell does that mean, right? And here I get up, and I'm listening to all of these luminaries sort of reminisce about, like, the various problems that they had sending the first packets through to, you know, from UCLA up north, and, like, what was going on? And I was like, really now? And they asked me this sort of question, and they were like, so how does your generation feel about, you know, us who've created the internet? And I was like, so I hate to put it to you, but we don't know you exist. As far as we're concerned, the internet's always been here, and, well, it's kind of cool, and we like it. And it was a really sort of eye-opening moment. And I actually, you know, there was a point at which I started to realize that learning these stories, learning this lore became really important, because I started to see the cycles in it. And I had this great opportunity to sit down with Howard Rheingold and hear about, like, all of his original, you know, incarnations and how it stemmed from his 1960s political activities, things that we've seen written up by people like Fred Turner, from counterculture to cyberculture. So I think as you look at like us old fogies and realize that we get much older much faster in this culture, is to realize that while it may not be that the hacking culture of our generation is the same as what's going on today, that there are these patterns with it, and part of looking in at it is having these moments of self-reflection is to say, what is this about? How does this relate to history? And like the reason to do that is to realize that there are these cycles that go long back that are arts movements and different challenges that were learned using whatever the systems were at that point. And realizing that doing so is not just an act of sort of inward looking, but it's actually a way of gaining strength as a culture. It's a way of actually taking all of the things that you do and making it more powerful, is to realize that gelling together in all of these ways, the ways that folks have done it over time, actually have lessons to be learned.
So, Dana, in a moment, you are going to answer 2, 3, and 7. and I'm going to answer 4, 5, and 6 in a single answer. And they keep moving around, but the ones that you get to answer are about internet and culture and marketing. And I'm going to answer these ones about cross-cultural memetics. So here's my answer. So here's the thing. We are doing an amazing job in this country of documenting US memes and increasingly Japanese memes. And, you know, once again, tip of the hat to my friends at Know Your Meme who've just done gorgeous work around this. And my hope is that this is now going to be an opportunity to sort of look a little bit further and try to figure out how can we go to a wider world. So for years, sort of my day job has been a website called Global Voices. And Global Voices does something really simple. It basically says there's bloggers and videographers and photographers all around the world. We're going to find the really cool stuff. We're going to translate it into English if it's in Swahili or Cambodian or whatever. And we're going to make it clear that everyone can pay attention to it. And what happened really early on was we realized that it's impossible to do when you're just doing it from America. What you actually need to do is to find the dude in Namibia who's reading all the African blogs and who can become your Africa editor. And so Dasanjo Macha is now our Africa editor. And so at some point for Know Your Meme, there's going to be probably a Kenyan African meme curator who is somehow going to be within your posse and is going to be figuring out how to push this forward. So getting onto the more serious questions about, is this just for the lulz? Because I agree with you, that should be in more keynotes around there. It isn't just for the lulz. In fact, in China, memes are incredibly political. The one that probably everyone has heard about at this point is the river crab and the grass mud horse. Is that familiar? So at least we're getting some laughs out of that one. So when Chinese bloggers started getting censored, right, they would say, damn, my blog just got censored. I have to start a new blog. And then the word censored got censored. So when you would say I was censored, that got you censored. So what you would start saying was, damn, my blog just got harmonized. Because the language of getting censored would be, for reasons of social harmony, your blog has been removed from this server. So you would start saying, my blog has been harmonized. And so predictably, the word harmonized got blocked. And so what then happened was, people realized that there's a word that sounds almost exactly like the Chinese word for harmonize, which is the word river crab. So for a while in the Chinese blogosphere, everyone would talk about, damn, man, my blog just got totally river crabbed. I'd been working on that thing for weeks, and it just got river crabbed out of existence. And so you started this, and then there was another thread of Chinese sort of cultural hackery that invented this mythical animal. And the mythical animal looks like a llama. It shows up in videos. It often shows up in videos fighting against the river crabs. And this mythical beast is called the grass mud horse. And it's because if you say this phrase in Mandarin, it sounds like something that I'm not going to say, even in this context. It's a really, really unpleasant swear word. And so what was wonderful was this video of little Chinese children singing the song of the grass mud horse, basically singing, your mother's cunt, you know, back and forth and back and forth, and which is a great way to sort of poke fun at the Chinese censor. So this stuff is intensely political. And whether this gets to the question of whether memes will save the world, look, it's easy to laugh about, but a viral idea, a good idea that gets spread from one person to another, pretty much is the only thing that does save the world. You know, the only thing that changes in the world are people deciding, hey, it would be really nice if instead of having a king rule all this land, we all got together and sort of decided who might represent us. Democracy's a meme. Inequality, reducing poverty is a meme. Worrying about carbon emission is a meme. These are all memes. It doesn't have to be just silly just because it's memetic. And understanding how these ideas fight and get back and forth and get attention, it's not just interesting for figuring out how to get several million people to look at your YouTube video. Ultimately, it's deeply political.
And I think the thing to keep in mind is that political isn't just about political with a capital P, but all of the ways in which it becomes locally and culturally political in different ways. And I think it's really interesting, we're very much sitting in an American context here. And one of the beautiful things about American sort of history of subcultures and all sorts of uprisings is that we almost always focus on uprisings around governments. And it has to do with everything that's embedded in the American sort of history. And at the same time, we often rarely think about these sort of economic controls that go on in this country. And I actually think that's, getting to these questions about the economics and marketing, they're actually deeply connected to a lot of what Ethan's talking about, sort of high politics. Because, when I spend time in Europe, the assumption is, of course, well, it doesn't matter what the government, does with all of this. This is totally fine. But it's deeply problematic what the corporations do. And it's deeply problematic the ways in which money is made off of people. And we get back to these longstanding questions of labor, right? Who makes money off of your efforts? Is it you? Is it, you know, and if it's not you, how does it get distributed? How does it get abused? What are the, you know, sort of inequalities that come in around economics and labor? So when I think about marketing, one of the challenges here is these ways of actually usurping power from people. Just like when we come back to these questions of censorship, it's a slightly different way of controlling power, but it becomes part of these same stories of sort of questioning what is the infrastructure? Who is actually in power? Who is getting privilege? And more we're seeing in the United States in particular that money and politics with a capital P have become really deeply entrenched with one another. They're part of the same story. So when we think about marketing, what we actually are really thinking about is how do we feel about contemporary American capitalism? Are we happy with the ways in which it's going? So part of why I get so frustrated with some of advertising culture is when I spend a lot of time actually looking into who clicks on ads, I surface something very disturbing. It's not that anybody clicks on ads. It's not evenly distributed who clicks on ads, right? Most of you have figured out how to put the Mozilla plugins in so you don't even see ads, right? Those who click on ads are inevitably those who are least privileged. The ways in which your materials are being used is often to market to people who are actually don't have the affordances to be able to do this. If we look at the economic crashes in this country, it's unevenly distributed in terms of effects. And so when I think about these ways in which we have to question the marketing infrastructure, the marketing apparatus, is to actually think about the ways in which this has become such an advertising culture, but that advertising culture is not about making money in an evenly distributed way. And I think we really have to question what that means and what that means to be a part of it.
So, hey, Tim, was that a keynote?
It was a keynote.
Awesome. All right. Thank you.